Hello, this is your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, Priscilla Corja, in Flagstaff with Northland Views. Today is December the 10th, 2024. I'll be reading from Art Dolls Will Strut in Fashion Show by Staff Reporter, published on November 27th, 2024. Step into a world of enchantment and creativity at the Art Doll Fashion Show in English Tea, which will take place on Saturday, November 30th from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. at 285 South 6th Street in Cottonwood. This event will combine the whimsy of art dolls with the sophistication of an English tea party for an unforgettable afternoon. Guests will have the opportunity to meet the artists behind these extraordinary creations, learn about the intricate processes and creativity involved in making art dolls, and relax and enjoy a cozy afternoon filled with inspiration, tea, and delicious snacks. Whether you're an art enthusiast, want to learn more about art dolls, a tea lover, or simply looking for a delightful way to spend your afternoon, this event is perfect for all ages. The Art Doll Fashion Show in English Tea is brought to you by a creative team behind a unique pop-up gallery by Gifted Hands. That's inspiring as the art it showcases. Guided by a passion for creativity, Sid and Nora Sims share a mission to have fun, feed their creative addiction, and find loving homes for their cherished creations. Unlike traditional galleries, their space operates with flexibility and purpose. Located in a 600-square-foot space shared with a mini-storage leasing office, they focus on hosting events, seasonal openings, and appointments tailored to the customer's needs. This approach allows them to spend more time creating while still connecting with their visitors. Through this gallery, they aim to bring you closer to the textures, colors, and emotions of a truly creative life. Join this special event and be a part of this artistic adventure. Reserve your spot now at the website or by giftedhands.com. Spaces are limited. Admission is $5, which includes a spread of English teas and treats. For more information, contact Nora Sims at info@bygiftedhands.com or 928-300-5508. And that's the end of the article. ACF Burton Awards $335,000 to Verde Valley Nonprofits by Joseph K. Giddens, published on November 28, 2024. The Arizona Community Foundation of Sedona held its annual grant award ceremony on Friday, November 15th, coinciding with National Philanthropy Day. During the ceremony at the Sedona Performing Arts, ACF awarded $229,700 in grants to 63 area nonprofits and representatives of the Burton Family Foundation, an organization that partners with ACF regional offices to facilitate nonprofit funding in rural areas, distributed an additional $105,310. It's a day to celebrate the good in the world, ACF Vice President Jennifer Perry said. There's a lot of crazy things happening, but this is a day for us to focus on what we can accomplish when we come together as a community and what we can do to support each other as neighbors. The Cornville Community Association received $3,500 for four initiatives within its Make a Difference project, including financial assistance for low-income student aid, support work for agricultural education at Oak Creek Elementary School, community cleanup days in Lower Oak Creek Estates, and an immunization drive in conjunction with Yavapai County. The Emerson Theater Collaborative received $3,600 towards its planned September 2025 production of Anita Yellen Simmons play Silence is Not Golden Project. On the topic of domestic violence, the proceeds from which will go to the Verde Valley Sanctuary. The Sedona United Methodist Church is going to collaborate with us, Emerson producer Camilla Ross said. We'll have a discussion after the project with the Sedona Police Department will be a part of. We're grateful when we get a grant from the ACF or the Arizona Commission on the Arts because it's helpful for us as an organization, as a nonprofit organization, to be able to have the very best for Sedona. That costs money, and so whatever show I do, I want to make sure that any patron that sits in that seat will get the best, the most professional show that we can offer. The Sedona Arts Center received $3,100 for its annual Pline Air Festival, which celebrated its 20th anniversary in October with 21 artists participating. About 2,000 people attended over the course of the 9-day festival, SAC CEO Julie Richards said. Each artist is their own entrepreneur. Each one of them is a small business, so they're all making money to support their lives. The Sedona Symphony received $3,600 for performances at the Sedona Winds Retirement Community in collaboration with the Sedona Arts Center, Chamber Music Sedona, and the Yavapai Symphony Association. We're also forming a close relationship with the Sedona Public Library. They hosted a fundraiser for us last month, and we just shipped our grand piano to them for their exclusive use, Symphony President Margaret Davis said. This year is all about collaborations for us at the Sedona Symphony. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul's St. Johnny Vianney's Conference Rental Assistance Program received $3,500 and an additional $5,000 from the Burton Foundation. As of October 2024, about 30 families had received rental aid through the programs, with many of the requests coming from residents of manufactured homes, according to St. Vincent de Paul volunteer Maureen Koza. Low-income student aid received $7,000 for its greatest need fund that would be used to fulfill direct financial aid requests from students in low-income families, including anything from doctor visits to lunch debt or extracurricular fees. Sedona Toys for Tots received about $2,600, which local coordinator Angela Thomas said would be used to purchase toys for children between the ages of 10 and 13, because a majority of toy donations are specialized toys for kids for ages 3 to 6. What a lot of people don't know about Toys for Tots is that every chapter has to raise their own funds, Thomas said. A lot of people think that the toys that come in the boxes are enough, and it's not really enough on its own. Sedona Area Veteran and Community Outreach received $2,300. It's helped to supplement the cost of the Memorial Day service that we have each year, so it covers supplies such as water, chairs, printing, and advertising, SAFCO President Jack Ross said. Our budgeted amount is $3,400, so that covers a good portion of it. The Sedona Community Food Bank received just over $4,000 from ACF to partly cover for the cost of a refrigerated van, which also could help with our food deliveries to our clients because we have people in need and we're delivering to them, SCFB Executive Director Kathleen Healy Biza said. We had an anonymous donor that's already helped us out with the cost of that, $10,000. Because I think the cost of this van is going to be somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000, but it might be more. We need more money to give back to the community, Perry said. The needs are not getting any smaller, but when people give through the Community Foundation, we have the benefit of pooling our gifts so people like myself can give to the community funds to make an impact today and know that it will grow for the future. So my goal is that as people, as they make their giving decisions from now to the end of the year, give it to the community fund so we can do more next year and for generations to come. 98 funding applications were reviewed by 50 volunteers prior to the awards being made. ACF will also be releasing its updated Northern Arizona Giving Guide, which highlights projects they would have funded if resources allowed. This guide will be available in a few weeks at azfoundation.org. Education is one of ACF's strategic focus areas, and the need in our region is immense. A quarter of our applications were for educational needs, ACF Regional Director Sherry Denny said. It's $25,000 to start a fund at ACF, so any interested community member could start it in their name. For more information on charitable giving, contact Denny at sdenny@azfoundation.org or 928-399-721. And that's the end of the article. National Forest names Filbert as District Ranger by staff reporter, published on November 29th, 2024. Bobby Filbert started in her position as the new district ranger of the Bradshaw and Chino Valley Ranger Districts on October 21st. We are thrilled to welcome Bobby to the Prescott National Forest, Forest Supervisor Sarah Clausen said. Her background and experience make Bobby a great fit for the forest resources we manage, the communities we serve, and the team we have here on the Prescott National Forest. Filbert is from Salmon, Idaho, where she served as a strict district ranger from the Salmon, Cobalt, and Leodore Ranger districts in the Salmon Chalice National Forest. She began her Forest Service career in 1995 as a wildlife technician with the White River National Forest in Minturn, Colorado. In the beginning, it was alpine skiing that brought me to the Forest Service, Filbert explained, and I stayed for the love of mountains and a connection to the conservation and the people. From 2000 through 2022, Filbert worked as the Sawtooth National Forest in Ketchum, Idaho, as a wildlife biologist, then as the Forest Wildlife Program Manager. Her last year at Sawtooth was spent as Deputy Area Ranger for the Sawtooth National Recreation Area, based in Stanley, Idaho. Throughout her years with the Forest Service, she has taken on details and special assignments, including National Resources Staff Officer for Sawtooth in 2017, Deputy Area Ranger for the Sawtooth National Recreation Area in 2019, and District Ranger for the Dillon Ranger District of the White River NF in 2021. For the past many years, she has also served on incident management teams as a lead public information officer and liaison officer. Filbert received a bachelor's degree in zoology from UC Santa Barbara and completed graduate work in environmental sciences at UC Santa Cruz. She has two young adult daughters, and her husband is a district ranger within the Forest Service in Idaho. In her free time, she enjoys hiking, mountain bike riding, skiing with her family, cooking, and going for long walks. Throughout my career, the Forest Service has offered me beautiful landscapes to explore and opportunities to engage collaboratively with communities and partners to implement our most important restoration and conservation work, Filbert said. I believe we are stronger, more resilient, and go further when we work together. I am grateful to be here on the Bradshaw and Chino Valley Ranger Districts and look forward to engaging with the communities and our numerous forest partners. And that's the end of the article. You're tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to Northland Views. Authors discuss new book detailing Sedona movie history by Joseph K. Giddens, November 30th, 2024. The Sedona Heritage Museum's 2024 Sedona Story Speaker Series concluded on Thursday, November 14th, with co-authors Diane Phelps Budden, Chris Seeholzer, and Janine Trevelyan, and photographer Mark Elder discussing their 2023 book, Sedona Movie Locations, Then and Now. I'm assuming that most people in the room are boomers, because this is such a walk down memory lane if you are, Budden said. All of us either saw it on the screen or on our TV because we were growing up. Published by the museum, the book is part guidebook and part picture book and is intended to help film fans locate filming locations for 21 major motion pictures that were shot in Sedona. The book also juxtaposes historical film photographs with contemporary images of the same location. Since Zane Grain's The Call of the Canyon was filmed in Oak Creek Canyon in 1923, more than 100 feature films have been shot in Sedona, and earning it the nickname Arizona's Little Hollywood. Between the late 1930s and early 1960s, Sedona became a hub for Western film productions, where nearly 20 movies were produced between 1945 and 1950. Cesar Romero, Tyrone Power, Joan Crawford, Henry Fonda, and Glenn Ford were among the many stars who worked against the backdrop of the Red Rocks. The whole idea of being able to see places that you have no concept of what they look like and have no thoughts that you have been able to ever travel to, which really, even when you look as far into the middle of the 20th century, there are a lot of people who still didn't think they would ever be able to travel, Trevelyan said of how film viewing once took the place of tourism. I grew up in Munich, Germany, Seeholzer said. I knew every American Western. I knew every movie star, and my childhood, whole childhood and teenage years was dreaming about one day getting to this place where all the magic took place. Sedona's big filmmaking era ended in 1968 with the completion of the last two films in the guidebook, Fire Creek and Stay Away, Joe. The former was shot at Schnebley Hill and Cross Creek Ranch in atop Airport Mesa, and starred Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart. The movie's opening scene at Sedona Airport required Fonda and his movie gang to ride their horses at a full gallop next to the runway while the film crew drove parallel to them to capture the dramatic moment, the book stated. For the making of Elvis Presley's Stay Away, Joe, Presley arrived with his new wife, Priscilla, and his full entourage for the six-week shoot. The film featured Presley as a Navajo scrambling for a solution after a prized stud bull that was supposed to bring financial freedom to the tribe was accidentally eaten. One of the things I also did try was to watch all the movies, Seeholzer said. I finished most of them, except Stay Away, Joe. It's so bad. I could not get through it. The book notes that movie lovers can find the locations for Stay Away, Joe at the intersection of the State Route 89A and Forest Road. Sedona Camera Club member and location photographer Chris Elder visited a movie site that now with a barbed wire around its perimeter. I hold the hands strands of barbed wire open for my wife, and she goes through. And she goes wandering off into the brush, and she turns around and says to me, "You coming?" Which means, "You're coming," Elder said. I proceeded, and lo and behold, the tension on one of the strands snapped back away, and I flew. I landed on my back, and my phone is going off in my chest pocket. I'm saying to myself, who wants to talk to me? It's my phone. It says, "You've fallen. We're going to call 911. This book was a labor of love, and it was a fun process, and it was something we put off to the point there was a bunch of pent-up demand, Trevelyan said. So we're hoping that there will be plenty of people who will enjoy it. And that's the end of the article. Election Counting is Complex When Margins Are Close, by Christopher Fox Graham, published on December 1, 2024. Covering election results in Verde Valley is not as easy as one might think. Some races involving county votes in both Yavapai County and Coconino County, which can be decisive in determining the results of a close election. We often have elected officials or those supporting various ballot measures contacting us by text and email on election night to see what numbers we have to make sure they're reading the results correctly. The first drop on election night consists of just the early ballots cast before election day that were dropped off or mailed in, and those usually only count for about one-third to one-half of the total vote. Even though these numbers don't take into account the day of voting, we post the results after they come in around 8 p.m., so poll watchers on our website have some understanding of how the election may go. Over the course of the night, sometimes as late as 2 a.m., the results can articulate this, how the race went between day of and early voting. Come the Wednesday morning after the election, many, if not most, races have decided one way or the other. One candidate for Mingus Union High School District Governing Board, incumbent Carol Ann Teague, prematurely declared victory on election night when she was in second place for the three open states, but only 70.4% of ballots had been counted. Her celebratory Facebook posts nearly received nearly 90 comments. Her jubilation came much too soon, as she quickly dropped into third place as a day of votes were counted and ultimately fell to fourth place, losing her seat. She issued a mea culpa days later, dashing the hopes of her supporters who relied on the statement from a single candidate on election night rather than a news source like us or even the county elections results website. "We got swamped by Project 2025 and Moms for Liberty," T claimed on Facebook, citing no evidence, while ignoring her own culpability. Voters remember when officials insult children and punish and punished them at the ballot. In the Yavapai District 3 supervisor race, Democrat Nikki Check had a lead in early votes for Republican Lori Drake, but we did not call the race for her, although other media outlets that don't understand the complexity of ballot drops, tabulation, and new signature verification rules jumped the gun and called her as the outright winner, misinforming voters about a race that we knew certainly would tighten up. We at Larson Newspapers, however, finally made the call for Check on November 13th, when the math was clear. Check ultimately won with a comfortable 226 vote margin after previously crushing her Democratic primary opponent, incumbent Donna Michaels, by 72% to 28%. Michaels had only defeated then-incumbent Randy Garrison in 2020 by 179 votes by organizing a last-minute push against Verde Connect, which gained her support from Middle Verde residents, but they redistricted out of District 3 following the 2020 U.S. Census. After Michaels was elected, she improperly attempted to terminate two planning and zoning commissioners in the mistaken belief that she had the right to do so. One refused to bow to her pressure, the other resigned. Michaels then appointed her major campaign donors who was opposed to project near his home to the vacant seat, thereby enabling him to kill it. As the COVID-19 pandemic hit, Michaels promised Jerome residents that they could cut in line to get vaccinations, violating both state and federal policy. The Yavapai County Board of Supervisors chairman publicly revoked her promise and rebuked her the next day. For the rest of her term, Michaels maintained a lower profile, but consistently kept making promises to constituents that were never filled. She attacked Northern Arizona Healthcare, which runs most of the region's medical facilities, and was cited for a collision in a county vehicle. By the primary, voters simply had enough and wanted an alternative. Check was the alternative, but was also a respected figure in Verde Valley politics. In the general election, given their years of community service, either Check or Drake would have been an excellent replacement for Michaels. Voters who knew Drake as president of the Mingus Union High School District Governing Board largely voted for her, but most of Sedona and the village of Oak Creek went for Check. While smaller precincts leaned towards Drake, Check had support from communities whose residents knew her as the mayor of Jerome, through her work at Yavapai College or her previous runs for the Arizona State. And that is the end of the article. Wagner to Run Montezuma and Tuzigu, by staff reporter, published on December 2, 2024. The National Park Service has selected Penny Wagner as superintendent of Montezuma Castle National Monument and Tuzigu National Monument. She began her assignment on November 17th. The position reports to the Southern Arizona Office Superintendent based in Phoenix. We are excited to welcome Penny Wagner as a distinguished leader, as the superintendent of Montezuma Castle and Tuzigu National Monuments, said Southern Arizona Superintendent Patrick Putnam. With her experience as a superintendent, public affairs specialist, and interpreter, Penny is uniquely positioned to lead us into this new chapter. Having begun her career in Arizona, she has come full circle, returning home to her first park with a wealth of knowledge, passion, and vision. We look forward to a bright future under her guidance. Wagner has worked for the National Park Service for more than 15 years, more recently as the superintendent at Florissant Fossil Bells National Monument in Teller County, Colorado. Her first work experience with the NPS began with a summer internship as a volunteer park ranger at Montezuma Well while she was in a graduate school at Northern Arizona University. She went to work a full-time at Montezuma Castle and Tuzigu National Monument after graduation, followed by Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve, Redwood National and State Parks, and Olympic National Park. Wagner holds a master's degree in anthropology from National Arizona University and a bachelor's degree in anthropology from Arizona State University. I am thrilled to return to the Verde Valley and honored to serve as the next superintendent at Montezuma Castle, Montezuma Well, and Tuzigu National Monuments, Wagner said. I look forward to working alongside the park staff, volunteers, tribes, partners, and local communities to continue the legacy of dedicated stewardship of these special places. Wagner has moved back to Arizona with her husband, three kids, and family dogs. Her husband also works for the National Park Service in the Intermountain Regional Office as a recreational fee program analyst. Wagner succeeds Lloyd Masiyapotewa, who recently accepted a role with the NPS Native American Affairs Office. Montezuma Castle National Monument. On December 8, 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt signed the Antiquities Act, declaring four historic sites of historic and cultural significance at the first national monuments. Among these was Montezuma Castle, which Roosevelt identified as a place of the greatest ethnological value and scientific interest. Although very few of original artifacts remained in the structure due to intensive looting of the site, Roosevelt's dedication ensured the continued protection of the best preserved prehistoric cliff dwellings in North America. Montezuma Castle National Monument quickly became a destination for Arizona's first car-bound tourists. In 1933, Castle A, a Pueblo ruin with 45 to 50 rooms, was excavated, uncovering artifacts and greatly enhanced the understanding of the Sinagua people who inhabited the riparian oasis along Beak Creek from 1100 to 1425 CE. Early visitors to the monument were allowed to access the structure by climbing a series of ladders up the side of the limestone cliffs. However, due to intensive damage, public access to the ruins was discontinued in 1951. Approximately 350,000 people a year visit Montezuma Castle National Monument, Tuzigut National Monument. The Sinagua who built and lived in the rooms of the Tuzigut Pueblo were a part of a thriving communities with trade connections stretching hundreds of miles. Tudigs, or Tuzigut, is a Tanto Apache term meaning crooked waters, which refers to Peck Slate, a cut-off meander of the Verde River. The Pueblo at Tuzigut consists of over 100 rooms and was probably home to several hundred people for several hundred years from 125 to 1400 CE. After the Sinagua left, the Pueblo stood empty until the early 1930s, when it was excavated by archaeologists and then turned into a national monument on July 25, 1939. I'm your volunteer reader, Priscilla Corja. This was Northland Views. Join us each weekday for views from around the Northland. Thank you for listening.